Hello, this is Terry Burdick reading to you today from the Commercial News, the weekend edition, for Saturday and Sunday, July 25th and 26th. Wow, where did July go? I know I'm not the only one thinking it. The next time we read together, it will be August. Wow, the summer always seems to go so fast. Today on our front page, let's take a look at the top headline. It is Uncertain Future. Major concerns for the mall are leaky roof and vacant storefronts. And this comes to us from reporter Christy Jankowski, and the dateline is Danville. The Danville Village Mall used to be a bustling place, according to Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. Now the city's code enforcement staff is making sure it's safe for employees and patrons. The Village Mall suffered damage to its roof during the torrential downpours back in June. Since then, the Village Mall County Market is closed for good, and there are still buckets collecting rainwater in the main portion of the mall. Can we talk about the mall for a second? Asked Ward 6 Alderman John Cooper during Tuesday's City Council meeting. I mean, when we found out that the roof was leaking, did the city do anything about that, or has the city done anything about this roof? Williams said during the meeting the city did immediately go into the mall following the storms in June. That's when we got the closure. That's when County Market closed their doors, said the mayor, noting they were still determining whether or not code enforcement will penalize anyone. On Friday, Williams said the city's legal division is involved. Our legal division oversees our code enforcement. We have issues with leaking stuff inside of the mall, Williams said. They have to address that for safety reasons. As to whether the mall will close, Williams says it's up in the air. However, he says there's buckets everywhere, literally buckets, and there are sections cordoned off. Williams also said that when one of the new owners who took ownership earlier this year, who does not want to be named, told him the previous owner's insurance is supposed to cover the roof damage. Unfortunately, the leaks and the stuff started when they were in transition of purchasing the property, and so it should have been disclosed and covered by the previous owner's insurance, Williams said. It's my understanding that they are in the midst of litigation with them. Currently, the Village Mall has three separate owners. Slumberland owns Slumberland, what used to be Sears, which is now Slumberland, and Shoe Sensation, said Williams, noting the grocery part is owned by a different party. And then the entire rest of the mall is owned by this other owner, and that is where City Trends and Hibbett Sports are still operating. Williams places most of the frustration on one previous owner, Jimmy Virk. That's one of the things that makes me so angry about all this. Everyone is doing the right things except for the previous owner, the mayor said. We were working with the owner to reimagine its uses and possibly repurpose it, and we were even willing to partner with them to provide a study about uses. They either couldn't or wouldn't come up with their portion of resources. Williams said now the biggest concern is safety. We're just trying to make sure that everyone's protected, he said. You just got to make sure that you protect people as much as you can. Also trying to balance business interests. At this time, the mall is largely vacant compared to what it once was when it was a movie theater, a food court, multiple places to shop, as well as a dining option like Garfield's. On January 24th of this year, Bath & Body Works closed its doors at the mall, and Dunham Sports closed in December of 25. The Village Mall was sold earlier this year in an online auction for $1.2 million. Now there's only a Slumberland, City Trends, Ross Dress for Less, Pet Supplies Plus, and Hibbett Sports. There is also community education provided by Danville Area Community College. This is a continuation of a story that we read last week. Looks like District 118 is once again taking up the issue of staff raises. The headline, District 118 to vote on raises, and this too from reporter Christy Jankowski. Dateline Danville, will District 118 employees see a raise in their salaries before the school year begins? It will be up to the board vote on Monday. The District 118 School Board will be holding a special meeting to vote on raising salaries Monday evening for administrative staff and flat salary employee recommendations. During the July 17th meeting, the board tabled voting on salary raises and originally said they would likely vote on them in August. Christopher Easton, a board member, was against voting on the raises, highlighting the district has only 46 days of cash on hand, and remarked on the unknown cost of the storm damage to Mark Denman Elementary from storms in June. The damage resulted in a part of the gymnasium roof ending up in yards and across a section of road. Easton raised concerns about being fiscally irresponsible by approving raises when the cash reserves are wiped out. On Friday, Eastman's viewpoint had not changed much. However, he does agree the staff deserves a raise. I don't think the outcome will change, though. I believe the board will likely vote to raise the salaries, mostly because the administrators are deserving, Eastman said. However, he's glad the board tabled the item last week for transparency's sake. I consider them, the agenda item for raises, to be controversial because of the nearly $250,000 raises, when you count the benefits and everything together, and I just didn't think it was right. It was the right time to be talking about raises, Easton said. I'm glad that it slowed down the process so that we can have more transparency. Board President Darlene Halloran motioned not to vote on the matter and said that due to that, they could not even discuss the agenda item. Superintendent John Hart spoke out in favor of bringing raises for discussion, highlighting how the staff had brought down the district's deficit to $1.6 million versus around $8 million last fiscal year. However, what I wish this would have been is a conversation before tonight, Hart said. I don't think we'll be bringing back administrators or flat-salaried employees wearing the smiles on their faces that they should have this time of year. Easton says his biggest question for Monday night is what financial status do you have to be in to stop spending money? Easton says if the board continues spending, they will have to vote to increase taxes or at worst, and even worse in my opinion, to potentially have to vote to borrow money on an emergency basis. That's something I definitely did not want to do, but we're very close to needing that. So in the end, Easton says this is just going to be another hard call for the board. No one wants to say you can't have a raise this year, or we have to cut this program. That's not fun at all, Easton said. But you know, when you run for office, you got to make difficult decisions. If we're really doing what the community wants, we'll have to say no to things that people want to say yes to. The board will meet on Monday at 5:30 p.m. Well, taking a look around at some of our neighbors with their celebrations, Indianola is celebrating 190 years. And this too, an article by Christy Jankowski. Dateline Indianola. The Good Old Days Festival returns on Saturday to ring in the 190th anniversary of Indianola. We're small but mighty, Village President Holly Austin says about Indianola. We're the third oldest town in Vermilion County. The historical event coincides with the country celebrating its 250th anniversary with accolades from President Donald Trump and Senator Chapin Rose, a Republican from Mahomet. I think it's all honoring in a sense, Austin says, and something we're very proud of. Austin has been village president for almost 2 years. The festival will take place from 1:30 to 9 in the Indianola Square. There's a parade, a cruise-in, a kiddie carnival, a bounce house, and a water slide combination. Kiddie tractor pulls, donkey dumps, cake walk, silent auction, a 50-50 raffle, a petting zoo with Highland cows, and lots of choices for foods and drinks. The theme is basically back to the time when things were simpler and, you know, not as commercialized. And fun was affordable, Austin said. There's free parking, it's fun, affordable for the family, and we just want everyone to come out and share what Indianola has to offer and enjoy our history. The parade lineup was 1 o'clock, the kiddie tractor pull registration at 1:30, and wristbands for park activities cost $5. If you want to sign up for the parade or the kiddie tractor pull, head on over to the village's website. Some of our games, like the Indianola Jail, it's where you can pay to have someone arrested, in quotes. The games are like a quarter and then you pay a dollar and it's called bailout and revenge. You can bail out yourself and get revenge and have that person arrested, Austin said. Or you can pay for $10, you can get out of jail free card all day and then you can't be arrested anymore after that. The crews and donations will support Valor and Animal Rescue. Elmer and Snoke and those three guys will perform from 5 to 8 p.m. President Trump sent in a letter to the village acknowledging the anniversary. For nearly two centuries, the village of Indianola has been a shining beacon of rural American culture, pride, and heritage, the president wrote in part. As we celebrate 250 years of glorious American independence, we honor the immense history and rich traditions of your beloved communities like yours, which are forever enshrined upon the fabric of the American story. I know you all will continue to carry forth the beloved legacy of Indianola for generations to come. Senator Rose gave a letter of certificate of recognition to the village, stating that the Illinois Senate of the 104th Assembly acknowledges Indianola in their 190th anniversary. The certificate says in part, commends their devotion to the people of Indianola and to the state of Illinois on this monumental occasion. I think with Indianola, one of the things we struggle with is people forget we're in Vermilion County because we're small. And it just makes us, well, makes me feel like, you know, we're seen and that our contribution has been acknowledged. Austin said, all the money that we raise goes back into the funds for the good old days so that we can continue this event in the future. I know if you're hearing this story on Monday, this event has already taken place, but we will extend our congratulations and celebrate with the citizens of Indianola. Let's turn our attention to some future events that we can participate in and get on your calendar. Here's one for you. Red Mask presents Glengarry Glen Ross. Red Mask Players Ghostlight Studio presents Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet, July 31st to August 9th at the Catherine Randolph Theater at 601 North Vermilion Street in Danville. According to a release from the Red Mask Players, this Pulitzer Prize-winning play is about a small-time cutthroat real estate salesman trying to grind out a living by pushing plots of land onto reluctant buyers in a scramble for their share of the American dream. Mamet writes with brutal power about the dream and about the tough life of tough people who cajole, connive, wheel and deal for a piece of the action, an existence where closing a sale can mean a brand new Cadillac, but losing one can mean losing everything. The play, intended for mature audiences only, will have 7 p.m. evening performances on Friday, July 31st, Saturday, August 1st, Friday, July 7th, and Saturday, July 8th, with 2 p.m. matinee performances on Sunday the 2nd and Sunday, August the 9th. Tickets are $22 for adults, $20 for seniors, and $10 for students, and they can be purchased online at redmaskplayers.com or at the door, but reservations are recommended. The cast includes Jeff Brewster as Levine, the OG of the group who's been wheeling and dealing for decades. Andrew Smith plays Williamson, the office manager. Other salesmen are Drew Mertens, who plays the rough, obnoxious Moss, Zach Moore, who plays the eager but nervous Aaron Rowe, and Andy Long, who plays Roma, the smooth talker who could sell snow to Eskimos. Peyton York plays Link, one of Roma's buyers, and Dwayne Baldwin plays Balin, a detective investigating an office burglary. The play is directed by Justin Smith. For more information, contact the Red Mask Players via email at redmaskplayersboard@gmail.com. That sounds like a fun one. In other local events for this week, the Foodmobile stops in Vermilion County. The Eastern Illinois Food Bank announces the Foodmobile will be distributing food to local families facing food insecurity in Vermilion County this month. On Tuesday, July 28th, the Foodmobile will make stops in Rossville and Ridge Farm. The distribution is part of the Food Bank's Foodmobile program, a system of mobile food pantries designed to bring nutritious food to rural and underserved areas. The first stop on July 28th will be at Christman Park in Rossville from 9:30 to 10:30. Followed by a stop in Ward Park in Ridge Farm from 11:30 to 1:30. For a full schedule, Foodmobile FAQ, and more, visit eifoodbank, that's for Eastern Illinois Food Bank.org. Taps on Tuesday this week, the program will feature local historian and reenactor Doug Spike Sowers, a local historian and reenactor. Sowers will talk about the Henry Kester family buried at Spring Hill Cemetery across from the Soldier's Circle. The Kester family has a military history dating back to the Revolutionary War. Taps will be sounded by Anita Zeller. The national anthem will be performed by Rebecca Woodrum, while Tara Otter and Larry Weatherford will host the program. Taps on Tuesday is presented at 6 p.m. each Tuesday through Labor Day at the Spring Hill Cemetery Soldier Circle by the War Museum, Danville Township, and the Ward Hill Layman Civil War Roundtable. In case of rain, the program will be held at the Moore Museum, and if you need more information, give them a call at 217-431-0034. Also, Bismarck Lions are hosting a Jonah Fish Fry. The Bismarck Lions Club will serve Jonah Fish Fry meals from 3:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, August 1st at Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin High School at 17268 East 2750 North Road in Bismarck. Tickets for the meals are $12 for anyone 13 or older, $5 for kids 6 to 12, and free for those 5 and younger. The fish and sweet corn are all you can eat and are served with three sides. Sponsor packs of 10 Tickets are available before August 1st for $90. That sounds fun. Put that on your calendar if you're in the area. Bismarck Lions Club at Bismarck Henning Rossville Alvin High School, 3:30 to 7:30 on Saturday, August 1st. We don't usually spend a lot of time on crime in the area, but we do have a couple of articles today about some ongoing situations. Danville man accused of murder back in court. This comes to us from Christy Jankowski. A Danville man accused of first-degree murder in a November 2024 triple shooting that killed Keith Stone, 33, of Danville, and Ezra Adams, 17, of Danville, is due back in court on Monday. Recently, Danville police announced a second arrest in the case, stating in a release they were charging Mario Scaife, age 18, of Danville, in connection with the same shooting. Kashawn J. Cotton, 21, of Danville, is facing charges for as well. After speaking with Deputy Chief Doug Miller, Scaife was arrested on October of 2025. The arrest on July 3rd was to have him formally arrested and booked on the homicide charge. Scaife was arrested and booked into the Vermilion County Jail on the warrant for the November 2024 shooting on July 3rd, 2026, Miller stated. The arrest warrant was issued in 2025, and the other individual, a co-defendant, was arrested and booked in the Vermilion County Jail at the time the warrant was issued due to being in custody already on unrelated charges. Any other information would be improper to share due to Scaife's status as a juvenile at the time. Online Vermilion County court records indicate that the Assistant Attorney General Jim Papa is representing the state for prosecution of Scaife, and the Assistant Attorney General Brian Holmes is prosecuting Cotton. Scaife and Cotton have been in custody since their arrest in October. Scaife is due back in court on July 27th, and Cotton is due back in court on September 8th. Police said the case is still under investigation and will not release the name of the third victim who was injured in the double homicide. Anyone with information related to this investigation is encouraged to contact the Danville Police at 217-431-2250 or to report a tip to Vermilion County Crime Stoppers anonymously online at vccrimestoppers.org. In our second story headline, Danville man arrested on burglary charges. A 20-year-old Danville man has been arrested for car burglary. According to a release from Sergeant Andrew Brooks of the Danville Police Criminal Investigative Division, during the early hours of Thursday, July 23rd, patrol officers were dispatched to several vehicle burglaries and attempted vehicle burglaries in the northwest portion of the city. Citizens contacted police indicating they had video of the suspect. After reviewing the video, officers identified the suspect as Dawson Shaw, 20, of Danville. Shaw was out on custody on pretrial release for a separate pending criminal case in Vermilion County. Officers located Shaw walking in the 1500 block of Harmon Street around 11:30 a.m. and took him into custody. Shaw was booked on charges of burglary to vehicle and criminal trespass to vehicle. The Danville Police Department thanks the community who provided vital information and evidence. This case is an example of citizens and police working together to reduce the criminal footprint in our communities, said Brooks in the release, noting that all suspects are considered innocent unless proven guilty in the court of law. Anyone with information related to this investigation is encouraged to contact the Danville Police at 217-431-2250 or to report a tip to Vermilion County Crime Stoppers anonymously. You can go online at vccrimestoppers.org. Normally we would take a break right now from our stories to look at any death notices that were received on Friday, but none are presented in today's paper. So we'll just keep going on into our editorial section. Our headline editorial today says, putting the brakes on e-bikes. It's every driver's nightmare, cruising along a dark city street, suddenly someone on a small, almost silent electric bicycle pulls out of a side street, or turns into traffic from the sidewalk. With luck, all involved avoid an accident. The scenario occurs too often. Illinois lawmakers passed new laws governing electric bikes, electric scooters, and other devices known as micro-mobility devices. The regulations will go into effect January 1st and will hopefully curb the growing dangers associated with e-bikes. Westville officials recently conducted a session in an effort to educate the public on the new rules. The law breaks these devices into three categories, so those that can travel faster than 28 miles an hour, those that travel slower than 28 miles an hour, and electric scooters, skateboard, and unicycles that can reach speeds of up to 20 miles per hour. After January 1st, those on the fastest e-bikes must be at least 16 years old and will be required to have a valid driver's license, be insured, and have the device registered and titled through the Illinois Secretary of State's office. Operators will be banned from sidewalks, bike paths, and bike lanes. They must operate in regular traffic lanes. The state's driving while impaired laws also apply to operators of these high-speed devices. Those operating e-bikes that are pedal-assisted or throttle-assisted with a top speed of under 28 miles an hour must be at least 15 years old. Operators of a pedal-assisted device that can go over 28 must be at least 16 years old. The devices will be allowed on streets, bike paths, bike lanes, and trails. They cannot be operated on sidewalks. The third classification includes scooters, skateboards, and unicycles that can travel up to 20 miles an hour. Operators must be at least 16. The devices can be used on bike lanes or on streets with a speed limit of under 35 miles an hour, and these electric devices are banned from sidewalks. The law allows local authorities, including park districts and forest preserves, to create their own restrictions in the micromobility devices. E-device operators who violate the law can receive regular traffic citations, which can include expensive fines, and police can impound the offender's device. Police might find it difficult to apprehend apparent offenders due to the device's mobility off and on the streets. Lawmakers apparently hope just the threat of fines or having the device impounded will be enough to persuade operators to stay within the guidelines. The issues associated with the e-devices will continue to grow. These new laws will not only make our streets and sidewalks safer, but should help protect e-bike operators as well. Well, here's a topic that I've been hearing quite a lot of and chatted about in circles that I run in, and it's not too far off of anybody's email feed in the event that you do watch your social and other online headlines and reviews. Endless daylight savings time imperils public safety. And this is again from our editorial page today, brought to us by guest columnist Jim Schultz, who is a CNHI columnist and founder executive director of the Democracy Center and author of Lessons from Lockport, Dispatches from the Great American Divide. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill to change the nation's clocks to daylight savings time all year round. If it passes the U.S. Senate and signed into law by President Trump, it will be a solid proof of one thing. It takes 50 years for America to forget how stupid something is. I was a junior in high school in January 1974, the last time Congress moved the country into year-long daylight savings time. The experiment was such a disaster that it was promptly repealed the following October. The motivation then was energy conservation. America was suffering from oil shortages under a boycott by Middle East producers. The theory was that by having more daylight in the evening throughout the winter, Americans would use less electricity to light their homes. But an hour of extra daylight in the evening in winter also means shoving sunrise later by an hour. Depending where you live, that meant the sun wouldn't shine its first light until 8 or 9 a.m. The reason I remembered this so well is it was the first time I'd ever walked to school in the still pitch dark. All over America, the story was the same. Children from kindergarten to high school went out in the dark to walk to school or catch the school bus. The dangers of that became real when 8 school children in Florida were killed in traffic accidents in just the first 2 weeks. Other children around the country were injured in collisions with cars as well. As an example, this is what changed would mean here where I live in Lockport in western New York State. In mid-December, our local sunrise would be at 8:20 a.m. in the morning. Students at Lockport High School will already be finishing their first period. Students at Aaron Mazel Junior High will already be in their homerooms. Our elementary school students, children as young as 5 years old, will be already walking to school or standing on a corner waiting for a bus. Thousands of children forced to stand or walk on dark winter roads covered with slippery ice. What could go possibly wrong? This motivation for the change that this time around is not energy conservation, but convenience. A lot of Americans just don't like the hassle of moving our clocks backward an hour in fall and forward an hour in spring. People complain because it's too much sleep disruption. I find that hard to swallow. Every day, more than 3 million passengers take airline flights in the U.S., most of them crossing at least one time zone and usually more. Americans are happy to change their watches and lose an hour of sleep to see family or go on vacation or attend a work meeting, but then they are willing to force the nation's children to walk to school in the dark because they find it annoying to change our clocks by an hour twice a year. Some people say the solution is to keep the nation's clock on permanent standard time. We would dodge those dark winter mornings by giving up an hour of our long summer days. I say no to that as well. What use do we have for an extra hour of summer daylight at 5 a.m.? I prefer the summer joy of having hours of light after dinner, for children to play, and for families to take a bike ride or a walk together, especially if it's to go get ice cream. When our students head back to school in the fall, we fill their backpacks with new pencils, pens, and notebooks. We shouldn't need to add flashlights and reflective sashes as well. For more than 100 years, America has lived happily with sunrise before school in the winter and sunlight into the late evening all summer. Changing that back in the 70s was wacko, and Americans regretted it. It would be just as wacko to do it today. And again, that's an editorial brought to us by Jim Schultz. If you'd like to reach out to him, you can do so at jimschultztherewriter@gmail.com. An impactful blessing. OSF's Ayler ends up third in nationals. And this is an introduction to some articles that are in our sports group today, and it comes to us from reporter Marvin Holman. Dateline Catlin. Devin Ayler has definitely made the most of the blessings in his career. The incoming junior from Oakwood Salt Fork made that national stage in taking third in at 144 pounds in Greco-Roman wrestling at the U.S. Marine Corps 16U Junior Nationals at the Fargo Dome in Fargo, North Dakota. It was a blessing to go and compete for Team Illinois, Ayler said. It was an amazing opportunity to go out and do what I love to do. Ayler made the most of the Greco-Roman part of the tournament by calling his OSF head coach Vince Chambliss when he did not place in the freestyle part of the tournament. My relationship with Coach Chambliss is second to none, and I call him even when it's not about wrestling, Ayler said. The relationship we have been able to build in the last 5 to 6 years was crucial in how I perform, and it helped me to have a better tournament in Greco. He was the sixth seed out of 128 wrestlers in freestyle, so he was expected to place, Chambliss said. He called me after the freestyle and we talked for 45 minutes and it put him in a different headspace. I said, the tournament's over and you can't do nothing about it. It's time to move on and you have to wrestle more freely and enjoy yourself. He took off and won 3 or 4 straight to go to the semis, which guaranteed him to medal. He went again against the number one seed and was beat 4-0 by the eventual champion, Shave Ostermiller of Alaska. But he fought back and he was able to run into the kid that eliminated him in the freestyle and battled back to beat that kid to take third place. Ayler defeated Riley Watts of Iowa 6-5 after Watts beat him by pin in freestyle. Ayler said to win a major place in a tournament with the atmosphere like the Fargo Dome had was amazing. The atmosphere was absolutely electric. And there are so many people from across the country and they love wrestling, Ayler said. There is a lot of respect since everyone knows how hard it is to get there and compete in the level that we're competing in. It's a crazy atmosphere with a ton of respect and a lot of fun. That was not the only major tournament Ayler has been in this summer. In January, he went to the Tulsa Nationals and took second in the 15U 135-pound bracket. It was the first time an Illinois wrestler to compete in a major national event in the IHSA's new revised non-school competition rule, which said an athlete can compete in up to 2 non-school competitions during a high school season with a third permitted if sanctioned with a sports national governing body. The tournament ended a lot of hard work by Ayler as he started training with Unity coach Logan Patton for the event in March. Congratulations, Devin Ayler. We'll take a little bit of spattering for some other sports going on in the area. Speakers lose to Galesburg. The post-210 speakers' chance to repeat as Illinois American Legion champions took a detour on Friday. The speakers lost a hard-fought 6-5 game to Galesburg post-285. The winning run for Galesburg came in on a wild pitch, which added on to 3 errors that cost the team, according to post-210 coach Brent Hart. Guess it was tough all around for the Danville sports teams. The Dans fall short against the Bombers. The Danville Dans lost their second game in a row on Thursday, losing to the Dubois County Bombers 8-6. The Dans scored 2 runs in the first inning, added a run in the third for a 3-0 lead, but the Bombers scored 5 in the fourth and 3 in the fifth to wrest the lead away and keep it. Well, let's wrap up our time together today with a look at the weather for the week. Regretfully, there are no pictures that have any weather that will be wet for us at all this week. It looks like the week is going to be hot in the upper 80s, 90s to start the week, ending with the coolest day will be a high of 85, and lots of humidity hanging around with our lows in the upper 70s or the lower 70s and upper 60s. So It's going to be a hot one out there. Everybody take good care, hydrate, use sunscreen, you know, all the things that your mom told you. This has been Terry Burdick reading to you from the Commercial News. Have a great week. We'll try this again next week.